This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 75 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim, of course, is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Peter. Great to be back.
Yep, good to be back. Sadly, Gareth Stringer, who, of course, is the editor, Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource, has been again taken from us by his day job, or as we record this by his night evening overnight job, as he's on call and been called in. So apologies from Gareth for not being here today, but we are of course joined by our naval air historian Matt Willis. Matt, welcome back to Extended.
Hi Peter, hi Tim, good to be back.
Matt, busy time for you, very busy time for you.
Yes, very much so. Lots of irons in the fire.
Yeah, thanks for joining us and devoting the time to talk on our third episode on the Falklands Air War. This one is all about two aspects of the campaign we've not really talked about. We first get to talk to Philip Crabtree, who was a Fleet Air Arm engineering officer, and he was responsible for keeping those Sea Harriers we heard in part one and part two operational, particularly when they returned from operations. But also he talks about some of the battle damage they incurred. We then go on to the end of the conflict and see what happened to defending the islands from the air when we get to speak to Dave Gledhill about his role in the RAF for the two tours in the Falklands that he made. The latter as flight commander of 1435 flight, of course flying the Tornado F3. We'll also get the opportunity to look at some feedback from the first two episodes, but our first interview comes from Philip Crabtree, and as I mentioned earlier, he was a Fleet Air Arm engineering officer, and I asked Philip when he last saw Commander Sharkey Ward.
Well, I saw Sharkey about 4 years ago when we had an anniversary dinner for the squadron. So every 2 or 3 years, we tend to have a squadron reunion at Yeovilton.
Yeah.
And the engineers and the pilots, we all get together and have a chat and a soiree and just talk about the past and everything else, yeah.
And what was he like? He's quite an enigmatic character. Certainly was very vocal on our last episode.
He is. He's a very good leader.
Yeah.
I'd say in my time in the Navy, he's one of the best commanding officers of a squadron.
Yeah.
He's very bully in the china shop.
Yeah,
he goes for it full on, and if he doesn't get it, then he'll keep going until he gets what he wants.
Yeah,
but he's a very good leader. Does want to know all about his men, what they're doing, taking care of them, and it's all about making sure the squadron gets the best.
Right. Okay. And you've just been to a squadron reunion recently, haven't you? How was that?
Oh, it was our 35th anniversary. Yeah. We held it in the Fleet Air Arm Museum, and it just so happens that our first aircraft that we got delivered from British Aerospace, XZ-493-001, actually was on the ramp in the sort of near the Art Royal Exhibition.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great to meet people. You see how they're graying, they're getting older. Lots of them have retired, you know. We had a guy from Australia, Ian Charlton, who runs the museum, Fleet Air Arm Museum down in Australia. A guy from America, and of course you remember the people who are not here as well.
Yeah, bless you, bless you. Okay, well let's talk about your career then. Let's go back
to before the Falklands. I know a little bit about what you've done since, but tell us how you got into the Navy and what the background was there.
Yeah, I got interested in the Navy because I was actually in the Sea Cadets. My hometown's in Lancashire in Lytham St Annes, and I got basically a week visit to Royal Naval Air Station at Cordrose,
yeah,
and the Royal Naval Air Station at Lossiemouth, and thought this seems a good life. I quite like the idea of working on aircraft. So I took the exams when I was 15.
Yeah.
I joined HMS Ganges on the 13th of August 1968.
Right, okay. And what did you go in as? What was your...
Well, I had to go in as a sort of electrical mechanic.
Yeah.
And that because they weren't taking directly into the Fleet Air Arm at that time.
Right.
So I spent a year at Ganges and then transferred to the Fleet Air Arm as an aircraft engineer.
Right, okay.
So I did an apprenticeship at HMS Daedalus.
Yep, know it well.
So my first squadron was actually down at Cordrose, the Commando Squadrons, 846.
Yeah.
So I spent 846, and then I did a frontline squadron, 845, spending many a time in Arctic conditions in Norway, looking after aircraft in minus 20, minus 40 conditions, and doing the what they call the Cold War exercises.
Yeah.
And then I actually spent time on sort of 809, the Buccaneer Squadron, on HMS Ark Royal.
Wow.
That was my first foray into a fixed-wing sort of aircraft carrier. At the time, that was 1976. She only had a year before she was actually leaving the service. And then I went back to Rotary Wing on the Lynx. So I did the Lynx circuit for a couple of years. And then they said, oh, would you like to join the Harrier circuit? So I... In the meantime, I spent sort of about 6 years up at HMS Prestwick in Gannet, near Prestwick Airport.
Right.
Family, children, you know, as they come along. And but very, very pleased when I found out I was going to go to 801 Squadron.
Yeah.
So 899 were formed up in Yeovilton in 1979, which Sharkey was on that.
Yeah.
And then I joined 801 in January sort of 1981.
Right, okay. We're going to come back to that time in your life shortly. But you've gone on to have quite an interesting career post the Navy as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I was very fortunate when I left the Navy in 1985 that I got a job with BAE Systems as the engineering manager on the Buccaneer update. So I spent... I went to Woodford near to Manchester, and I was the engineering manager looking after the trials for the Buccaneer, where they were putting a new autopilot in, putting a new sort of radar in, new navigation system and so on, you know. But as usual in life, commercial things change quickly. So in 1986, they decided to make Woodford just a civil aircraft. Yeah. So I went on to... I moved then to Wharton in system engineering design on Tornado IDS for the RAF and ADV. Yeah. And I was actually, I designed the interface unit missile system for the Saudi Tornado.
Right. Okay.
Right from designing something from specifications to getting off the drawing board to get the first prototype built, to then doing prototype trials. And then we had to integrate all the different weapons that the Saudis wanted.
Yeah.
And then we did the release to service. And then they said, Philip, would you like to go to Saudi Arabia?
Right, okay.
So they offered me one of those deals that you couldn't refuse.
Yeah.
So I went out to Saudi Arabia, working directly in the Royal Saudi Air Force headquarters as the military advisor, not expecting that Gulf War One would happen.
Mm.
So I was there from 1989 to 1993, supporting the Royal Saudi Air Force in their strategy, their basing strategy, the CONOPS, future equipment buys, going around their bases and doing tours, and looking at the actual base and how well they sort of... are there any issues that need to be addressed with the prime supplier as BAE Systems?
So you'd gone from a very engineering-focused, a very hands-on-focused role, Navy, post-Navy with BAE and so forth. How would you describe the role that you'd taken on there? Is it systems engineer? Was it engineering? Was it software engineering? How would you describe that?
Well, it's more of a operational type post where you're looking at all the operational issues for the aircrew.
Yeah.
The issues of ground crew and supporting the aircraft throughout the life in service, but also advising the customer as to what things does he need to do to keep his aircraft actually in the air.
Yeah.
One of the things I did advise him about is that when I did a tour of the bases, Doran and Camismashate, where the main tornado base is, that the base in the eastern region had all the equipment to service the aircraft. But in the Camismashate, the poor prince in charge of that one had no equipment to service his aircraft.
Right.
So all the equipment had to go to Doran to be serviced. So I said, well, what happens then if somebody comes over the border and takes over Doran? It means all your capability of maintenance is gone for the equipment.
Yeah.
So they asked me to write a paper on it, and they agreed to spend £42 million on upgrading the base.
Right.
Shortly afterwards, Gulf War One happened.
Yeah, okay. And just briefly before we move back to the Falklands, Philip, tell me about some of these exciting projects. You've just come back from Saudi Arabia, just been doing some interesting stuff there. Can you just give us a quick run through of that?
Yeah, I've just come back from Saudi Arabia for the second time, working for the Ministry of Interior as what they call their aviation advisor. Now, the aviation advisor's job is to look at the current equipment in service, which is the S-70i and the S-92, and also look at the future procurement equipment buys to support the capabilities. So in my first tour with the MOI, we looked at, well, what is the tasking that they do for the 15 agencies? Mm. What capability do they need to do the job? Is it a rotary wing? Is it a fixed wing? Is it an unmanned? Is it rotary unmanned? And then from that, we determined what equipment they needed to buy. So the director, Ziad, invited me back last year to help him actually fulfill that promise to the MOI, which is deliver the equipment.
Right, okay.
So when I got back, it was actually analysing what he decided to buy and actually saying, did he buy the right equipment? Which was quite funny, because when I actually did the analysis, he'd bought the second choice rather than the first choice.
Right, okay. So,
which was quite interesting, because what you had to do was actually look at the performance of the aircraft.
Yeah.
Its speed, its time, its cabin capacity, its maximum takeoff weight, and look at the operational bases it could work from, and then give them an analysis and say, well, you know, which is the best equipment you should have bought, you know. Yeah.
Fascinating. So, fascinating stuff. So, Philip, let's go back to 1982. Where were you when things kicked off?
I was actually part of 801 Squadron.
Right.
We'd formed up in January 81, so I was already been on the squadron just over a year.
Yeah.
And we were busy working up the aircraft, because the aircraft had very little capability in terms of weapon load and so on.
Yeah. And at that time, from what we've understood, the aircraft was untested. It was very new as the Sea Harrier, as we know it, the FRS-1.
That's right.
It had limited capability, yet events overtook us. And before we knew it, they were either on Invincible Hermes or Atlantic Conveyor heading south. How did you journey down to the South Atlantic?
The squadron itself was actually on holiday.
Right, okay, so, yes, we've heard this story, yeah.
So we got called back very quickly.
Yeah.
So we had to get the aircraft out of sort of retirement as we put them into bed, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So all the aircraft were very quickly put together and made operational again. I went by helicopter from Yelverton with a lot of the ground crew and air crew straight onto the flight deck of Invincible.
Right.
So I travelled down to the South Atlantic on HMS Invincible.
Right, okay. Now, what about all your equipment, tools, spares, all of that sort of thing? How did that transit? How did that get onto Invincible? How did that all happen?
A lot of it was airlifted by the commando squadrons.
Right.
They took a lot of it either internally or externally. The bigger equipment was actually underslung loads and put onto the flight deck. There was some small equipment, that spares, that went actually by truck.
Yeah.
And had to get to in the dockyard, and we just unloaded it and took it up the gangway.
Right.
And the various stores people put into the stores areas, you know.
And as the aircraft was, again, so new at that time, your experience on the aircraft was relatively limited as it hadn't been in service. How did you know what to take in terms of spares and equipment?
Well, I think a lot of it was born from actually the equipment that we'd actually had to change during our first year, plus the other squadrons like 899 and 800 who'd been in service a bit longer. So you looked at the overall sort of equipment that had to be changed.
Yeah.
But the ship already carried a lot of spares for the Harrier anyway.
Right. Okay.
So it was just looking at what additional equipment would you need, because the squadron had been augmented from 5 to 10 aircraft.
Yeah.
So and then we had new engineers and pilots joining the squadron as well to augment the aircrew and ground crew requirements. And then looking at what sort of equipment would you need if you had to go on a forward operating base.
Right. Okay.
Because you always have to look at that as well, but you also have to look at, because one of the restrictions we had at the time when we left actually Portsmouth was that the engine had to be changed every 400 hours.
Right.
So that was quite a limitation for us.
That was the maximum life for those engines.
Maximum life, they had to change it. And of course, the equipment that was actually failing regularly, we knew already what it was, and that would be the EU WAC, the weapon naming computer, right, or the navigation computer, or components of the radar.
Right, would okay. So let's talk about that transit, because it wasn't just sit back, put your feet up.
Absolutely
and,
not.
And take it easy until things kicked off, was it?
No, I mean, from the word go, Smiths, who actually provide the software for the weapon aiming computer, had started delivering new software which would allow the pilots to do things like ground attacks, leapers flare, firing 2-inch rockets. We were very fortunate that shortly after the Falklands War was declared, the US DOD gave the 9L version of the Sidewinder to allow to do a sideways attack, because the 9G you can only do a rear attack with it.
Yeah.
So that left operationally for the pilots a much better envelope to engage the enemy with.
Right.
But the other issues we had was the software in the aircraft was not up to standard. Some of the actual equipment that you would have wanted, things like chaff and flare, no chaff and flare. So no actual protection system for the pilots. And the other thing we found also was that we had problems with the pilot's night vision.
Yeah. Okay.
So what we did is we actually, like good engineers do, you innovate away. So basically you couldn't turn the head-up display brightness down low enough so it wouldn't spoil the night vision. So we invented a filter, a red filter.
Right.
And we designed a bracket and a red filter, which was made out of basically cellophane.
Yeah.
And it would actually go over the head-up display and dim it and make it a red light, which was much better for the pilot's night vision.
Right, okay.
And then we actually invented a chaff and flare system for that. So the air brake, where the air brake is, there was actually, above it, there's like a panel, a square box panel. So underneath there, we put two packets of chaff with a lanyard attached to the main fuselage. When the pilot deployed the air brake, he deployed the chaff.
Right, okay. A bit Heath Robinson,
but it worked. We tried it, it worked. And of course, on the way down to the Ascension, we were firing leapers flares, then getting a Sidewinder 9L to lock onto it, so hitting the leapers flare with it.
And what sort of differences, from an engineering perspective, was the 9M and the 9L?
The 9G to 9L.
9G, sorry, to 9L.
Oh, it was a big difference. In terms of actually fitment to the aircraft, not a lot of difference. But in terms of actually the software, the software and the symbology that told the pilot when he could engage and when he could lock on was very different to the 9G.
Right. Okay. And again, from an engineer's perspective, how did you work with the pilots to make that a practical solution?
When we got the new software updates from Smiths, we then sort of brief the aircrew on the symbology, when would it engage and how they could attack a target. So gave them the new attributes of the new software, which allowed them to look at the various different symbols which were appearing on the head-up display or on the radar to tell them when to attack and when to lock on.
Right,
so on. And of course, some of the things we did was like a 1,000-pound bomb, the toss mode of the bomb.
Yeah.
So we can toss it from about 1.5 miles into Stanley and keep the heads down, you know. So there were various different modes that were actually fitting to the aircraft. But what we did find is that when we went to put the program in on the flight deck, we got to the rear of the island, got alongside the island, and the software wouldn't go in. And it gives you this indication.
By the island?
So the superstructure.
Yeah.
So to the right of the flight deck is called the island.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So to the left is where the aircraft spots are.
Right, okay.
So we're there with the software computer trying to put the software in.
Yeah.
And it's not going in. We find out that the operations room have got the 909 radar on active.
Right, I'm with you now, because when you meant, I knew what you meant, but I was thinking, well, what's that got to do with the software? So literally, they were jamming their own.
They were jamming it.
Right.
So what I did was go down to the chefs and said, give me some Baker foil.
Yeah.
Went up to the cable, wrapped it in Baker foil,
yeah.
Tie wrapped it, it worked every time then.
And for any of our American listeners, that's aluminium foil you use in cooking.
Aluminium foil, yeah.
Wow, okay. So that was the fix for the 909 radar.
Yes.
Let's talk then, as you steamed south, went past Ascension, so weather presumably was reasonable at that point, but started to deteriorate as you headed further south. What were the working conditions for you as technicians like? Because Commander Ward talks about it in his book, how challenging it was in terms of space, because the ships were pretty tightly packed.
Oh, actually, yeah, we ran full of helicopters and Harriers.
Yeah.
So there wasn't enough space down in the sort of flight in the sort of hangar to actually put all the aircraft.
Mm.
So some of them had to be actually rotated on the flight deck. So we keep about five or six aircraft actually on the flight deck in sort of readiness, various readiness modes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes or an hour. We used to have the pilots, sometimes they'd been on 15 minute readiness, but as soon as we left, as you say, Ascension, the weather deteriorated quite rapidly. Mm. Rough seas, squalls, raining conditions, which anybody who's worked on aircraft will realise that to keep an aircraft working when it's damp and it's wet and the dampness gets into the avionics bay, you've got to keep running it. So what we used to do on the shifts, the senior engineers would go into the cockpit. We would actually fire up the engines, fire up all the avionics, the weapon systems, head up the display, and we'd run it for about 25, 30 minutes just to dry all the systems out.
Yeah.
So we knew then when a pilot got into the cockpit, it was going to work for him.
Right, okay. And in terms of pilots to aircraft, did they have a unique aircraft or did they rotate?
Each aircraft had a pilot's name, but you find they did rotate because of the...
Because of all these sorts of challenges.
The challenges that we had, and actually, you know, the aircraft that were available to actually go and do sorties.
Yeah.
And depending on what different weapon fits you had on the aircraft as well.
Right, okay. And as the ship steamed further south, the aircraft were more active, they were getting more capability, testing the weapons and that sort of thing. What sort of role were the engineers like yourself having at that time?
Yeah, well, I was one of the senior engineers on the squadron.
Yeah.
So my job was to make sure that when an aircraft came down, get a debrief from the pilot, find out what was wrong with it, if anything, and then go out and fix it.
Right.
And sometimes, because of the number of aircraft we got, and we did ramp up to 12 at one time before we lost two. As you might know, we lost Al Curtis. And So basically, I was running between two or three aircraft, diagnosing the fault, getting the mechanics to change the appropriate box, going back in and doing the servicing, then going to the flight logs and actually saying the aircraft's now serviceable again.
Right.
And actually doing that, one of the things challenges we had two aircraft that needed an engine change at once. So the first for the first time.
So what's involved in an engine change on an aircraft carrier?
Well, you have to basically get the aircraft into the forward hangar where there's a crane.
Right.
Where you can actually, you've got the actual ability to lift the engine out.
Yeah.
So you actually have to disconnect 64 connectors, front and rear of the wings.
Yeah.
You then have to disconnect all the hydraulic and air pipes, and then you've got like four rings that you put into the top of the wing, and then you put the gantry over it and you can lift the wings off. And once you've got the wings off, you then have to disconnect the water tank, because there's 50 gallons of water to cool the engine, which is in the hover.
Yeah.
And then you disconnect all the pipes and the electrical connections for the ECU and the generator and so on, and then you can... There's a connector where a guy gets underneath the aircraft. He has to push it out. Then you lift the engine up. But we had to do two at once.
Yeah.
So we had to get one aircraft to a certain state.
Sorry, Philip. Why? What happened to make two? Was it just bad luck, bad timing, or was there a fault? Or?
There was a fault.
Right.
We ended up with a fault and one that needed a regular actual servicing.
Yeah.
Okay. We did get, very shortly after we went down south, when we got to Ascension, we did get permission from Rolls-Royce to extend the hours from 400 to 500.
Yeah.
But one of the other things that they do with the aircraft, they give it what they call a combat limiter. So the engine temperature on the combat limiter can go up to a much higher temperature.
Right, okay.
So if the pilot needs that extra power,
you can stress it.
Stress it more.
And does that reduce the service life of the engine? Does it?
Not necessarily, because the fatigue meter will actually monitor it, and it'll tell you whether it's actually been overstressed.
Right, okay.
So you can, and you can tell by the echo computer whether there's any issues there or not.
And going back, this, you know, 1982, we didn't have the technology in terms of diagnostics that we have nowadays. I mean, my car goes into a garage, the first thing they do is plug it in. How challenging was it for you as a senior engineer to monitor the ongoing status of all these aircraft?
Well, a lot of what you did then is you sat in the cockpit, you had the main navigation computer on, but what you could do is, and you get trained to do this by actually myself as a good engineer, I read the books and went into it. You can go into different store positions of the computer and find out if there's an error. And one of the biggest things we used to get was what they call ground speed runaway.
Right.
So, which means that when the pilot gets in and actually starts up the navigation system, it thinks he's doing 25, 30 knots, but he's not.
Right.
He's just in the flight deck.
Right.
So
why,
you have to
why
go
is
into,
that?
Oh, it's basically an error with the Franti computer.
Right, okay.
Where it's some of the errors within the computer build up
until
it shows itself as a ground speed runaway.
Right.
The computer only takes 2 minutes to align itself. Then you can go into the stores and find out what the problem is.
Right.
Then you can neutralize that. So I always used to check that. So 15225 was the actual runaway store.
So it's funny how all these years have passed, yet that sort of data is still embedded in your mind, isn't it? It's amazing.
It is. And so we used to work very closely with the... because a lot of the systems, like today, they are integrated together. So the radar and the weapon computer and the navigation computer and the air data computer are all linked together as one system. Mm. So if one of them shows an error, it's going to cause a fault with either dropping a bomb early or actually releasing your missile too early. So you have to make sure that the radar system's top line and the navigation system, air data computer and the weapon computer are actually all online.
So engineering an aircraft like the Sea Harrier, all these complex systems, all the mechanics, all the hydraulics, how were you able to cover all these functions? What skills and resources do you have in your team to do? Were they unique to a particular type of engineering? So, as I say, hydraulics experts?
So, in the Fleet Air Arm, you have people who cover airframes and engines. Mm. And that's all they do. They cover the hydraulics, the undercarriage, the engine, and the airframe. So that's one engineer.
That's quite a span, isn't it?
It is. The RAF have three people covering that role.
Yeah.
Then the RAF call it avionics, but we have basically aircraft electrics and weapon systems.
Right.
So that's another trade. And then radar and radio is another trade.
Right.
So those are the three trades that really cover.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is the weapons engineers loading basically bombs and bullets and other different weapons to the aircraft.
Wow. Okay. So all this was going on, and we heard in the previous episodes about the challenges of getting the aircraft ready. Where were you when things started to kick off and those first forays into battle?
I was on the flight deck launching the aircraft.
Yeah.
So we'd be there sort of... and the task group would vary depending on whether it's actually either 100 miles away or less, whether in the total exclusion zone or we're actually closer to Falklands. So we'd launch aircraft in parallel with actually the Hermes. And they'd typically launch two or three aircraft at a time to do combat air patrol.
Yeah.
So we'd be there in the actual, basically the aircrew ready room, waiting for the pilots to tell us when they're coming back.
Yeah.
So ready. And if they've been attacked, then we obviously knew there might be some problems we need to deal with there. But most of the time we were there waiting for either to launch more aircraft.
Yeah.
Because what you'd do is they'd be on task. So they'd be basically ingressing back to the ship. We'd then put two aircraft on in egress to the patrol areas. So Hermes would cover the north of the Falklands. We would cover the south of the Falklands.
Right.
But sometimes there'd be an overlap depending on when you're attacking an aircraft and so on.
Sure. Philip, emotionally, how was that when the crews departed? What was going on in your mind?
Well, I think a lot of us would think, is he going to go back? Is he going to be okay? And of course, when we had very early in the Falklands War, we lost two pilots through an incident. We knew those pilots very well. And emotionally, you think, you feel for the families, you feel for the people back at home who've lost somebody, you know. So, yeah, quite emotionally, but you also got this adrenaline buzz as well, because when you're in combat, it's like nothing else.
Yeah.
Your adrenaline's going, you want to get the job done, you want to get all those aircraft and keep them serviceable and keep them in the best condition so the pilot's got 100% of a platform.
Yeah.
So if he needs to use it in anger, he can do.
And is this, we talked briefly before we started recording here, is this where the power of leaders like Commander Ward really came into their own in terms of leading a team like that?
Yeah, I think definitely there are pilots who love to be involved in a conflict, and it gives them a big buzz and they operate it at 100% peak efficiency. There's other people who treat it as a flying club, and things didn't quite go the way they wanted it because they weren't that happy to engage, you know. So you know, you get people who are happy to do it, and of course Sharkey would suss them out very quickly as to which pilots were prepared to engage and which ones were actually standing off a little bit too much, you might say, you know. But I mean, it's one of those things anybody in the armed forces has to recognize that you're there, you're signed on, you could be in a conflict.
Okay, so operations had started, and the first time we swapped messages, you sent me some pictures. Let's talk about those aircraft coming back. We've talked about the challenges of maintaining and keeping them in the air, but these aircraft started coming back with holes in.
Oh, definitely. We had Steve Thomas, who was Sharkey's wingman. They went to do an attack on a couple of Prakara's ground attack aircraft.
Yeah.
And Steve Thomas got some 20mm bullets up the aircraft to the rear.
And was this from FLAC?
Ground FLAC. Fire. Yeah. Okay. Anti-aircraft.
Okay.
Attack. So the FLAC hit the aircraft to the rear towards the avionics bay and the sort of fin of the aircraft at the back, the tail. And also it went into the sort of main radio system.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Steve couldn't talk to the ship. He couldn't talk to Sharkey either, his wingman. Yeah. So Sharkey assumed he'd gone.
Right.
But actually he turned up about 10 minutes after Sharkey landed back on the ship, and just hovered and landed the aircraft, and then we went up and looked at his close call.
Right.
And there were these big holes in the aircraft.
And you sent me some pictures, and considering the sensitivity of the equipment in there, you know, the electronics, and although, you know, it does look quite solid, should we say, in comparison to the digital age we live in now, some of these holes, I mean, how did he get back? I mean, how did the aircraft continue to function?
Well, I think he was lucky that one of the areas where the bullets went through was close to two control wires that controlled the rudder.
Right.
It went straight through the center and hit the main radio. So he still had a mechanical functionality of the aircraft, even though electronically not all the systems were working. So he still was able to put it into the hover and fly it and get it down on the ground,
So let's talk about some of that battle damage. And you casually said to me in a message about, yes, we had to replace some wiring. I know what wiring in an aircraft is like. That was no mean feat.
No, I mean, one of the biggest problems is when a tip of a bullet goes through an aircraft, it wings round, swizzes round in the aircraft, and actually it nicks a wire, the insulation or the central core. So although we could see the obvious damage, which was the main radio loom that goes from the avionics bay up to the equipment bay, we just got a new loom and replaced the whole loom.
Yeah.
We did that. But the less obvious was then looking with a torch and a mirror, trying to find every wire that had been nicked.
Yeah.
So we could either put some insulation tape over it, or we could splice it together. And then sometimes we just had to switch on the aircraft systems and find out which ones weren't working.
Yeah.
Then trace the through the wiring diagrams where that wire went and where it was close to the bullets. And then actually find the wire that either shorted to earth or whatever and just repair it.
And, of course, you're doing this under battle conditions.
Absolutely.
Ship's under threat.
Yeah.
And although we've heard an awful lot about how well protected Invincible was, there was an incident where that I was unaware of where she came under attack from an Argentine sub.
Yes, there was. Yeah, on this particular day, there were three the Harriers on the flight deck, all armed with two Sidewinder 9L missiles and a 1,000-pound bomb on the center line. And two of the aircraft went off. The third aircraft was actually with the pilot in, the engines were started, and suddenly we heard this klaxon. And we thought, why is the klaxon going? Because normally the Argentinians would attack us about 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, just around sunset.
Right, okay. Was that because they were coming out of the west, coming out of the sun?
To try and hide, mask their attack, basically. Yeah. So they refuel over the Falklands and then come and attack the group with Eton Dards and Skyhawks, basically.
Right.
On this occasion, it was about sort of midday. And suddenly the klaxon went off, and the ship suddenly started to turn harder starboard. So we're thinking, what's going on? Because Invincible, she can turn very quickly. She can turn inside the circle of a Type 42 frigate, which is quite tight.
Yeah.
So she's turning, and the aircraft's now sort of starting to list a bit. And the nose wheel goes and turns 90 degrees to starboard.
So the aircraft was starting to slip
from that.
Right.
And, of course, a pilot must have thought what was going on. Next thing we know, the aircraft's gone off the back of the carrier, and the pilot's had to eject.
Now, that's quick thinking.
That is quick thinking. And we're hanging on to the guardrails, trying to keep on the flight deck.
So did you see the aircraft come over the edge?
Yes, we did, yeah. Yes.
Gosh, that must have been frightening.
It is. You think, what's going on?
Yeah. And the cause of this... The cause of this?
It was an Argentinian submarine. It was a World War II submarine they bought from the Germans a number of years ago. Mm. She fired two torpedoes. One fell short of Hermes, and the second one actually scraped the port side of Invincible right along the Plimsoll line.
Right. Didn't know that. And we lost that Sea Harrier.
We lost that Sea Harrier.
And how? What about the pilot?
The pilot was recovered after everything had calmed down.
Yeah.
And as he got into the aircrew radio room, we said, that's a different way to get a submarine. Send a Harrier down for it.
Yeah, and nose down. Nose down. And of course, because aircraft were limited, that reduced the capability of the squadron quite dramatically.
It did, yeah. And we lost another aircraft to a blowpipe missile. Yeah. Flight Lieutenant Mortimer was doing a basically dropping a bomb and keep your heads down sort of in Stanley.
Yeah.
As he got around the south of Stanley Airfield, he got shot down by a blowpipe missile.
Mm.
And so he was he ejected, he was in the water. But considering it was minus 20, the sea conditions were very cold. And then the Argentinians came round and tried to find him.
Yeah.
So he had his Sabi beacon on, his rescue beacon.
Mm.
They must have listened to the frequency, 243 megahertz, and thought, oh, we're going to find this pilot and capture him. So Mortimer basically turned his Sabi beacon off, which he was silent then. But as he said, it was very cold. And eventually, about 8 hours later, we picked him up in a Sea King helicopter. Where he was suffering from hypothermia.
Yeah.
So,
8 hours.
So they put him into a bath.
Yeah.
The one and only bath on the ship, which is the captain's bath, and warmed him up slowly.
Yeah.
And he was flying again 2 days later.
Because, of course, pilots were even more valuable.
Oh, pilots were very short,
Yeah.
Of course, with the number of hours they were flying,
they
were getting tired and fatigued, you know.
And that same pressure was being applied to the engineers as well.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, the engineers were working every hour we could, we worked. Basically, we split the actual, the whole of the maintenance staff into three shifts. So we'd have 2 8-hour shifts, and then the third shift would actually work during the night from 8 in the evening till 8 in the morning, but it would be a reduced shift.
Right.
So the main manpower was on the morning shift and the afternoon shift.
Yeah. Okay.
So you'd either work at morning and an evening, so you'd come on at 8 till midnight, or 8 till midday, and then you'd do the shift from 12 to 8.
Right, okay.
And that's how we split them. That's the way we kept the maintenance crew, you know, with stopping you get too much fatigue.
Yeah, okay, okay. So we've talked about some of that battle damage. You were one of the first engineers to operate from Stanley, from the islands. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they selected me because they said, Phil, you've done Arctic training. We've seen it in your records. You'll be ideal for going ashore. Hmm. And it had and believe it or not, we had very limited Arctic warfare clothing.
Yeah.
Because we'd been doing exercise clockwork, which is the Arctic warfare. And when we came back in sort of March, they offloaded it all.
Right, okay.
So when we went down south, we had very little Arctic warfare equipment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I went ashore and I was taken ashore in a Sea King helicopter. Dropped in Stanley and the first thing you saw was whiteout. Complete yeah. white snow everywhere, snowing conditions, yeah. and you didn't know where the plastic mines were.
Right.
So okay. you had to follow the trodden path. Yeah. And there were guys there with EOD guys with detectors, mine detectors, trying to detect the mines. I got out of a helicopter walking with my sort of Durgan, which is a rucksack,
yeah.
With my clothing for the next 10 days. And bam, guy went up in the air, lost half his leg.
Okay.
So you had to follow yeah. the trodden path.
Yeah.
Of course, one of
and this was on the airfield, was it?
This was on the yeah. airfield, Stanley Airfield.
Right.
And the control tower was shot up badly.
Yeah.
The airfield was still workable, despite what people say. It was, the runway was never taken out.
No.
It was. They never stopped aircraft taking off from there.
Right, okay. So, and of course, we were operating Harrier, so they had the capability for certainly short takeoff. Your role in those first few days, what were you doing?
Well, the first few days were basically to do combat air patrol. Mm. So we had four aircraft ashore.
And which squadron did they come from? From 801?
From 801.
Yeah.
So basically Hermes, they decided Hermes needed to go back up north because
yeah.
their engines were sick.
Yeah.
So they said to all the ship's company, and Jeremy Black was a great captain, mm. one of the best captains I've served with. He said, look, we're going to have to stay down here until Illustrious relieves us.
Yeah.
We don't know where that's going to be. August, September, October, we don't know. We're going to have to stay down and actually do cap from Stanley Airfield.
Right.
So what they decided to do was put the ground crew and air crew a limited number ashore for 10 days at a time.
Yeah.
Then rotate them round.
Right.
So I was okay. on the first 10-day stint. And it was establishing an area for the aircraft to actually be maintained.
Yeah. And was there any hangarage?
There were some inflatable hangars the RAF had put up. Then there were some covered hangars with like a canvas where the Harrier would sit in, a bit like what they call a Harrier hive.
Yeah.
And we'd put the aircraft in there to protect it from the wind and everything. And we'd try and do maintenance. But we'd do limited maintenance. We'd just, if there's a serious defect, we'd sort it out.
Yeah.
Of course, the issue was how do you get spares
yeah, yeah.
to an aircraft that's now ashore,
yeah.
away from the ship.
Yeah.
So one of the instances that came up, one of the aircraft had a blower motor that went down.
A what, sorry?
A blower motor. So it cools right. the avionic equipment in okay. the avionics bay. Now, I knew there was a Harrier that had been shot down at Goose Green. They'd Chinooked it, airlifted it to Stanley.
Okay.
So I went to that aircraft and we took the blower motor excellent. And made the aircraft serviceable again.
Excellent, excellent. And working in minus 20 degrees,
yes.
How do you service an aircraft?
Well, you have to be careful of any metal you touch is going to give you frostbite.
Yeah.
So you have to have gloves and you have an inner and an outer glove. So any of the tools that you use, you have to make sure you're wearing your gloves to do it. Mm. And in the equipment, basically in the cockpit, you could basically close the cockpit, start the engines, warm it all up. And then you could sit in comfort for about an hour or 30 minutes and maintain the navigation system, the radar and everything. So when the pilot got into it, it was going to be okay, you know.
Right, okay. And by this time, the aircraft were being probably pushed to their maximum, weren't they? What sort of engineering challenges was that facing?
Well, the engineering challenges were the limitation on the engines, because we only had a certain number of engines on the ship, and we were rotating them around and trying to get... on Invincible, there is an engine bay, so they can do a certain amount of engine servicing. So Rolls-Royce were allowing them to do a certain amount of servicing to give them another 500 hours of life.
Right, okay.
The limitation avionics was the equipment. There weren't enough navigation computers to keep them serviceable.
So
we had the guys in the avionics lab getting the circuit boards and trying to fix the circuit boards just to keep the navigation computers going and the weapon computers going. So normally you wouldn't do that. normally you would actually just...
Yeah, just replace it.
You just replace the the unit and you send it back for replacement.
Yeah.
One of the things we had to do, we did a AOG, aircraft on the ground, which was an O1 priority. Mm-hmm. In 24 hours, there was a Herky Bird dropping a new navigation computer off the port side of Invincible. So we get an aircraft serviceable.
That's how quickly.
All the way from the UK. Yes.
Wow.
That's how quickly you could rely on the RAF to get spares to us, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's nice to hear.
It is.
And what about working interagency? You know, we've heard some of the challenges of that, but it wasn't all bad, was it? You know, once you were on the island, you know, you had the army, you had the commandos, you had the RAF, we had the Royal Navy. You know, it was a multi-service challenge. How did you face that on Stanley when you arrived?
Well, it was a joint coalition, joint inter-service environment. Mm. But what you found is that they kept themselves to themselves.
Mm. Right.
Only on an aircrew level did they actually interact.
Yeah.
We never found any interaction with the chief techs of the RAF.
Right.
They used to do their bits, and we'd watch them do some tricks where they were trying to replace the laser guided nose on a sort of their ground attack harrier.
Yeah.
And we knew the wind was coming up. And they put this frame around, and this frame just whipped up, took the nose and the whole canvas, and blew it away from the aircraft.
Right. Okay.
So we did try to tell them some of these things, but they wouldn't listen. But it was different. When they came on the ship, we got the interaction on the ship. I mean, Hermes had a lot more interaction with the RAF than we did, because on Invincible, we were purely Navy.
Yeah.
We never had the ground attack carrier on Invincible.
Yeah.
We only met them when we went ashore and started working with them. And they were trying to do similar things like combat air patrol with us, so share the combat air patrol role.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the ground attack carrier wasn't actually designed to do that.
No.
So they modified the one of the aircraft, and one of the pilots went up one day, wheels up, both sidewinders down the runway.
Ooh.
And there was some Gurkhas on the left of the runway and an Aramaki 330 on the right hand of the runway. Two Gurkhas got the legs chopped off by a Sidewinder missile.
Yeah.
The pilot was so distraught, he landed. They were trying to console him, but eventually he had to go home for counselling.
Yeah, blast.
So those things did happen.
Yeah,
you know?
War is a terrible thing, and you know, we certainly don't want to glamorise any of that.
Yeah.
But Philip, I suppose looking back on that time now, and we've talked about some of the exciting things you've done recently in your life, just before we close, what sort of lessons do you take from your time in the South Atlantic?
On a broader context, I think the UK Navy was actually very short of things like an AEW aircraft.
Yeah.
That would have helped us a lot in actually seeing the enemy coming in from southern Argentina.
Yeah.
So that was one of the acute shortages we noticed. And of course, we didn't have any in-flight refueling. So that was another shortage. Personally, I actually look back at that time on 801 as one of the highlights of my career. It's something you never actually envisage you're going to do.
No.
But when you're in that environment, you work a lot harder, you're there, you're motivated. And when you've got people like Captain Black and Sharky Ward, they are the key people to actually keep you going in a time of conflict. But a lot of the engineers, I mean, I was 29 at the time when I went down there, so I'd already been 12 years in the Navy. So I had experience, but some of the younger people, and you did see this actually among some of the younger people, that they were very frightened about it. So part of my job was to actually help them and understand that we're going to get through this and it'll be okay. We're on the best ship. We've got the best people in charge of us, and they're going to make sure we don't do things. Because you might know that one of the things we did do, which Sandy Woodward and I met Sandy Woodward, by the way, after the Falklands, we went off to take the SAS to do the raid on the southern Argentinian bases.
Yeah.
And we were sent with a Type 42 frigate to steam through the night. We had a Seeking Mark IV on the flight deck. We stripped everything out of it apart from the seat for the pilot.
Yeah.
The SAS were put in at the last minute at 3 in the morning. Then we launched it, the helicopter, and then we made our way back to the task force. That was quite a big risk, because the Argentinians had seen Invincible coming for the southern Argentina. They might have gone hell for leather and tried to take her out.
Yeah.
So, of course, the Belgrano was a bit of a sort of, well, here we've got a pincer movement going on.
Yeah.
Are we going to be okay? Because one of the fortunate things about being on Invincible, Jeremy Black was very good at telling you what was going on.
Yeah.
And telling Sharky bits and pieces, you know, that we needed to know, just to make our peace of mind, basically, as to what we're doing.
So we knew what was going on.
So we knew what was going on, and we knew there was actually a thought process of what how we're going to counter it.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, what you don't counter is an exit attack. Cause because when we, on the 17th of May, the Argentinians launched an exocet heading for Invincible, but we fired our chaff and flare and it hit Atlantic Conveyor. Now, Atlantic Conveyor shouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
Atlantic Conveyor was supposed to come in after dusk into the task force, but she was there at 4 in the afternoon, so she took the hit, unfortunately. And then we had a rescue operation to rescue the guys from Atlantic Conveyor. Of course, one of the things I think that hit everybody was the first ship, Sheffield, like thinking now actually we're vulnerable. We
it's
could
real.
Actually be hit.
Yeah.
We could actually be killed, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we had some of the survivors from Sheffield come on to Invincible as well as Hermes, you know.
Right.
So, but it's one of those times in your life you never forget. Definitely.
Well, Philip, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for your service and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Navy Wings brings together flying historic naval aircraft, people, and the stories associated with flying from warships at sea. Navy Wings aims to inspire future generations and to create a focus for remembrance. You can support Navy Wings by becoming a supporter, making a donation, or becoming a volunteer. Find out more at www.navywings.org.uk. What a lovely chap. He came across to meet me in Farnborough, actually. Does a fascinating job now in the Middle East, but and has got many more stories to tell us. But the first one that jumped out to meet him was that they were jamming themselves and he had to go and get some Baco foil to wrap over the radars. I'd sort of understood where he was coming from, but didn't quite realise the enormity of the problems they'd actually caused themselves.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great story, isn't it? You know, and obviously this is why when you are testing things, I mean, you know, the upcoming QE, you know, Queen Elizabeth carrier, a lot of work going into that. One of the things you want to find out is, do any of the sensors, radars, electronic stuff, comms, jammers, et cetera, interfere with anything else? And if it does, you know, what do you do about it? So obviously the place not to find out this is just about as you're about to head into war.
Yeah.
But luckily it shows again, you know, the remarkable adaptability, resilience, innovation, you know, of ground crews, you know, and particularly sort of, Royal Navy, sort of like technicians, engineers, to work with what they've got, find a problem, fix it, you know, maybe that's also a sort of a difference between, you know, sort of serious air forces, serious air arms of, you know, people who, air forces who you hear about will get shiny kit and they'll have the pilots and then, you know, kind of the some manufacturer maybe go and visit them sort of like, you know, sort of 5 years later and the stuff will be kind of rusting away and you know, it's not being maintained, it's not being looked after, that kind of stuff. I don't know.
I thought the interesting thing as well, Matt, was when I asked him about his role as an engineering officer, the scope of the engineering capabilities they had to cover was enormous. I mean, he talks about ground speed runaway and resetting the aircraft's electronics because it technically thought it was flying away. But I was surprised that, you know, at the same time as resetting the radars and that sort of thing, he was repairing rudders and wiring and oiling and that sort of thing. Is that common in the Navy, that the wider span of air engineering technician compared to say the RAF?
Well, I think it came through, really strongly in that interview, just the extent of the task that the Navy engineers had at the time. It was really astonishing, I think. And while it's quite easy to look at it in terms of the, on paper, you've got airframe, but then that incorporates all of those different systems. And the fact that someone can have to be an electronic specialist at the same time as they're essentially bashing metal is really just quite astounding. But I think the thing for me was just how the engineers were the unsung heroes in that campaign. I mean, the fact that they were able to do things like integrate the new systems, develop solutions to problems as they were arising, keep the airframes going, make sure that they were switching the engines on the recommended time between overhauls, and doing all that in a tiny aircraft carrier, which, let's face it, HMS Invincible was a very small ship for a class and not the best environment to work in, down in the South Atlantic. So just the breadth of what they had to do, but the conditions that they had to do it in, and with a very new aeroplane that was really, I think they had to integrate a lot of those new features that hadn't been, that normally would probably have taken them a couple more years to introduce the capability. So yeah, it was an amazing interview, and what a bunch of people.
We've talked before about sophisticated aircraft or generations of aircraft on the display circuit, things like that, the Lightning, the Vulcan, how much sort of TLC you need to actually fly something those are in the civilian world as display aircraft. But do you think maybe that the Sea Harrier was the last generation where you could do that sort of on the spots type of stuff? I mean, could you imagine that sort of make do amend with F-35 or even Typhoon?
No, is the answer.
I don't know that. Yeah. It seems doubtful. I mean, even just to the extent of things like the composites in the structure, which are going to be very much more difficult than patching a conventional aluminium skin and things like that. But then the electronics are just of a different order of magnitude. And when you look at that photo that was provided of the radio that had a 20mm cannon shell through it, that's still sort of pretty basic looking stuff compared to what's in aircraft these days. And then just talking about the wiring and having to sort of going around the wiring loom and find out where something's been nicked by a bullet and kind of following it back to the source and replacing it. I don't know to what extent the sort of plug-in boxes and things like that on today's aircraft you could really do that kind of thing with. But I'm not an electronics expert by any stretch of the imagination, so it'd be interesting to talk to someone more current to see how it works.
But Baco foil in the F-35 repair kit. Yeah, probably not.
Well, that particular, there is a photo we'll put in the show notes, and that was, of course, Sharky Ward's wingman, Steve Thomas, who was hit several times by, as you say, 20mm shells. It is quite amazing. Those shells didn't do any fatal damage to the aircraft. And I think Philip was saying that they literally passed through the cables between the rudder, and if they'd have hit the cables, the aircraft would have not survived. But we'll put some photos in there, and over the next week or two after the show, we'll put some more photos out that Philip has provided for us of some of that damage that they had to repair on site in that hangar in Invincible, as well as changing engines as well. And we've got a photo that we'll also share on how they changed an engine. That point, Matt, of the engine life, I thought it was interesting that I think it started up at, was it 500 hours, 400 or 500 hours, but then Rolls-Royce, by the time they'd got well into the conflict, were allowing them to fly them for another 500. That's quite an increase in life expectancy for those. And we've heard a lot about the Harrier's engine source, but over time, was the power plant for the Harrier ever a real problem?
Well, I suspect part of that that increase is the difference between conservative peacetime limits and what you need to do during a war, and when you can expect that actually you don't you don't need the equipment to last for a certain number of years. You just need it to do its job, you know, there and then. But yeah, I mean, they did the Pegasus was progressively improved, and you know, it's increasingly more powerful and reliable versions were introduced. And I think this was one of the reasons that the Sea Harrier was eventually withdrawn in favour of the GR9s was because it had the more powerful engine that could bring back weapons in hot and high conditions. So it was but it was obviously a unique engine that was doing things that nothing else was. So I imagine there was a certain amount of the engineering in it that was quite specialised.
And just talking about hot and high, of course, it was low and very cold. Philip Crabtree was talking about going and doing his stint on Stanley, being shifted over to support the Sea Harriers on Stanley. But it was some of those basic things that he mentioned that when I listened to the interview again, but they didn't pack for cold weather conditions, not because nobody wouldn't have thought it was just another thing on the to-do list they just never got to. So working on Stanley in near Arctic conditions with no Arctic clothing, I mean, it's amazing they actually got those aircraft back in the air.
Yeah, beggars belief. And it's just unimaginable how difficult those working conditions can have been. And again, I think that's something that comes through very strongly from the interview, that makes it even more remarkable that they were able to keep all those aircraft in the air, turning them around and while developing these solutions for the various problems that were arising just through the normal course of the aircraft's development. And I'm left with even more admiration for the engineers, the entire crew of the task force that was down there under those conditions. There were so few, and this is a point I made in the previous episodes, there were so few Sea Harriers. The loss of one, whether that was out for an engine change or having damage repair or having some other fix, or whether it was lost in operations or falling off the deck, as we also heard about, was a serious loss to the task force. Yeah. The sheer success of the operation was incumbent on keeping those aircraft flying, and that they did that in those conditions is just I'm left with even more of a sense of how on earth did they manage it.
Yeah, and Tim, let's talk about that loss of the Harrier. I'd never heard that story about the Argentinian sub potentially getting close to invincible and her listing over, with the result that the pilot sitting ready to launch was literally tipped off the side of the carrier and into the sea.
No, that's a new one to me. But you can imagine, from nerves on edge, that any submarine alert will be taken very seriously. The one for you if you are a, you are a high value target. That's one thing that the captain of the ship will be really, really worried about, is that, can a submarine get in, a quiet diesel electric get in there and cause mayhem? And so you manoeuvre, appropriately. Yeah, I can definitely see it happening.
Yeah, interesting. Great stories from Philip. I think we'll probably bump into Philip again at some time. I think he's got some interesting stories from the Middle East to tell us, but that's maybe for another episode. Okay, we'll leave that there then. And after this break, we'll get to talk to Dave Gledhill, who, of course, spent two tours of duty in the Falklands after the conflict had ended. First flying the F-4 Phantom and then returning a few years later as flight commander flying the Tornado F-3.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
I'm Peter Dixon, and I listen to Extended, the ETOPS aviation podcast.
Dave, welcome back to Extended.
Hi, Peter.
Dave, we want to talk to you about the Falklands conflict and the role you had after the end of the conflict. But just before we get to that, where were you when the conflict started, and what were your thoughts about it?
Well, funnily enough, I was still on 92 Squadron on the Phantoms at Wildenrath, but we were deployed down to Cyprus on an armament practice camp, so our annual gunnery exercise. And I vividly remember that we all heard about the upcoming conflict in the when we were in the bar, the officers' mess bar. So there was a lot of mad flurries to try and find out where on earth the Falkland Islands was. I mean, most of the pilots, I think, thought it was somewhere off the west coast of Scotland. And it came as a little bit of a shock that it was 8,000 miles away. So, we were a long, long way from home at the time we heard.
Were you and most of your colleagues eager, dare I say, use the term, to get involved and see what role you could play?
Well, I guess so. I mean, the on 92, originally, we were actually the first squadron that was put on call to go, in that we were the overland experts, if you will. You know, our normal job in Germany was overland, and of course the Falkland Islands, albeit out in the middle of the South Atlantic, it was an overland environment potentially.
Yeah.
So but the problem, of course, was that the Phantom couldn't get down there because there was no runway. The runway at Stanley at that time was only 4,000 feet long, which was way too short for a Phantom. So and I'm sure we'll chat about that later on, but so literally, there was no option to send the Phantoms, and the Harriers were the obvious choice for that role.
Yeah, and what Phantoms were you flying? What models were you flying at that time?
I was purely an FGR-2 man.
Right.
I flew the FGR-2 both in the UK and in Germany. The FG-1s, of course, were all up at Lucas, and slightly different fit.
Right, okay. Okay. So, Dave, in your book, The Fighters Over the Falklands, you set the scene a little bit about how fixed-wing RAF Defence of the Falklands worked and how it was all pulled together. Just before we get into your role, can you give us a little bit of a flavour of what happened once those Harriers had gone back on their ships and departed?
Sure. There was a little bit of a short spell before that. Obviously, after the conflict ended, the RAF Harriers were deployed ashore.
Yep.
And operated from Stanley Airfield, you know, on the shorter runway. They were rapidly adapted to carry the AIM-9 missile. So effectively, they were providing a non-radar but short range sort of air defense capability with just Sidewinder armed. And that lasted a couple of months until the Phantoms could be got down there. Obviously, as I said, we had to establish a runway, and the 4,000-foot stretch of concrete was literally a 2,000-foot extension was put on one end, on the westerly end of the runway, packed concrete taken out of a quarry just next to the airfield. And then a new runway laid over the top, which we actually got from the Americans. And this stuff is called AM2 matting.
Yeah.
And it literally is steel planking that is linked together and laid over the top of the prepared surface. And that then extended the runway to 6,000 feet long, which is just about adequate for a Phantom.
And of course, westerly, by that you mean the bit that sticks out towards the sea, don't you?
No, the other end.
Okay.
The threshold that's the easterly end of East Falklands, literally Cape Pembroke, the threshold is only just off the beach. So it was the opposite end. It was the Stanley end that was extended, and the bit down towards Boxer Bridge at the other end of the airfield. And then the matting was laid over the top of that, so giving a 6,000-foot strip to operate. And then the Phantoms, of course, in the guise of 29 Squadron, went down there in October of 1982 and operated as a full squadron, 29 Squadron, for some time until the end of 1983, when the squadron was then renumbered as 23 Squadron.
Right, okay. So what challenges were involved in getting the Phantoms down to down to Stanley? Because obviously we've heard and know about the stories of the chain of tankers taking things like the Vulcan down to the Falklands. How did that work for the aircraft like the Phantom?
Very similar. We can talk about my particular example shortly, but getting the squadron down there, of course, it's squadron strength, so 8 to 10 airplanes, whatever it was. I forget the precise numbers. I think it was 8 initially. But essentially, for two airplanes, you need about 4 or 5 tankers to get from Ascension Island down to Stanley. And the 29 Squadron were based in Ascension throughout the war. And then obviously moved forward once the runway was in place. So it's a huge number of tankers to get squadron strength of airplanes down there. And it took some time. I think it was 4 initially and then followed up by the other airplanes in due course. But it's a massive logistics chain and a massive number of tankers involved. But as we know, Ascension was absolutely mobbed with tankers throughout the conflict and then obviously for Airbridge and the resupply later on.
Yeah. When was the call for you then to head south?
I was quite a bit later. I didn't actually go down until June of 85. And I was called down for the first rotation of aeroplanes back to the UK. We were nominated. Essentially, the aeroplanes at some stage need major servicing. And two of the aeroplanes were coming up for that servicing. So we were sent down to actually bring the jets back. At that time, the tempo on the squadron was extremely high, and basically people worked almost a permanent shift. At the end of a 10-day cycle, you had at the end of one day off, but you were back on queue the following evening. So essentially, you worked every single day, and the powers that be didn't want crews who had been there for 4 months, actually for flight safety reasons, bringing aeroplanes home, because it's 2 8,000-mile transits, so it's a huge way across the ocean. So they sent us down as fresh crews to bring the airplanes back home. So I went down and I served on 23 Squadron for about a month, just over a month. And then we climbed in 2 Phantoms and headed north behind 5 BC-10s.
Well, tell us a little bit about what the challenges were like operating out of Stanley at that time.
I think the runway in itself was the biggest challenge. 6,000 feet of runway is not really enough to operate a fully loaded Phantom properly. You're looking really at about 7,500 feet for comfortable operations, particularly on landing. You can get airborne quite quickly, maybe 3,000-4,000 feet, even with a full fuel load and a full weapon load. But landing back on, we were landing on with about 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of fuel generally, a full weapon load and a gun.
Yeah.
And that's just a little bit too much for 6,000 feet. So we were landing into the arrestor cable on every single sortie. The arrestor cables, the rags, were stretched across the runway.
Yeah.
And they're normally used in emergency back in the UK, in the event of an aircraft emergency, a systems failure or something like that. But at Stanley, we were operating in order to stop in a short distance. And we got very good at it, as did the recovery crews. At the end of a sortie, both aeroplanes would break into the circuit. One aeroplane would land into the cable. We got used to being able to literally whip the hook up and disentangle ourselves from the cable very quickly, whereas normally in the UK, we tended to have to get the recovery crew to do that. But by a certain technique, holding the jet on the power, and then a quick wiggle of the hook, and it would actually disentangle itself from the wire, and you could then taxi away. At that stage, the recovery crew, the arrestor crew, would re-rig the cable, get the grommets back across the runway there, and then quite soon afterwards, the second aeroplane would land into the cable as well. So it was quite a slick operation in order to be able to operate squadron strength of aeroplanes down there.
And the extended part of the runway, did it cause any problems with things like tyres? Did that metal place any more pressure on the tyres than a normal tarmac or concrete-type runway?
No, probably less so, in that we were landing into the cable, so the actual rollout at the end of a sortie was probably less than an ordinary runway.
Yeah.
But the amusing thing was the runway tended to shift, and there were two ways to resolve that. Occasionally, the army, who provided a lot of support down there for us, they would take some planks off one end of the runway and shift them up to the other end of the runway as the runway slowly crept down towards the sea.
Right.
The other method of doing it was to stick a very heavy C-130 on the opposite end to wind up to full power and to roll down the runway and then stamp on the brakes, which also had the effect of moving the matting back up in the opposite direction. So it was a constant battle for the guys to keep the runway sort of in trim.
Yeah, okay. And Dave, as you transited down, what was your understanding? What sort of intelligence briefing did you get on the Argentine threat in terms of aircraft types and capabilities that you potentially would be up against?
Well, it was reasonably fresh when my first visit down there, and the rules of engagement were still fairly stringent. I suspect if a combat formation of Argentinian airplanes had come through, they would have received a fairly firm welcome. It was still very tense. We were still cleared to engage should it be necessary, you know, in the event of an attack. And of course, that was our role. You know, we were there as a defensive force to make sure that the islands couldn't be recaptured again. So very robust rules of engagement. We knew both aeroplane types, both combat aeroplane types, reasonably well. The Mirage, of course, we had many pilots who had flown it on exchange and the like. We'd operated against it in Europe, so it was a fairly known quantity. And the A4, again, the Skyhawk, we knew reasonably well. So we were fairly comfortable. We all knew that the Argentinians over the islands were operating at the limit of their endurance for those aeroplane types. And that was a huge advantage. It was an advantage to the Harriers during the war, and it would have been a huge advantage to us as, you know, in a phantom had it come to pass. But our strength, which at that stage over that variant of Harrier that was available at that time, was that we had the Pulse Doppler radar, we had the Sparrow, then Skyflash missiles by then, with a look-down, shoot-down capability. So we could extend well to the west of the islands because of the better endurance of the Phantom, provide engagement in depth, but also, had they come over the islands, we had a much more capable weapon system than the Argentinian aeroplanes were able to counter. So we felt fairly comfortable in our capabilities.
What sort of working up to be on active duty and on call, what sort of training and what sort of exercises did you do to prepare for that, or was that all done down in the Falklands?
Yeah, very little, to be frank. The only crews that were sent down there were fully operational crews, and the nature of the training on the squadrons at that time, you were expected to be able to cope with the type of threat that you might face.
Yeah.
And obviously, there was a little bit more emphasis on air combat training, I think, because it was essentially a fighter threat down there, whereas traditionally the problems we would have had in UK would be the mass bomber formations coming across the North Sea. So a little bit more emphasis on air combat and aggressive overland type operations, operating the radar overland, had specific issues and specific problems. So, but to be frank, very little extra workup for that environment. We were expected to know it, I think.
And one of the biggest challenges you talk an awful lot about in the book, of course, is the weather and the and the challenges that placed on the crews, the maintenance teams, and just the capability of the squadron to stay active. Tell us a little bit about how the Phantom coped with that. You talk about carrying extra fuel for bad weather, loitering, and that sort of thing. But it was never really enough for a diversion if you had to places like Chile, was it?
No. There are a few issues, to be frank. We deployed things called rubs down there. They were literally little rubber hangers, and the airplanes were put inside of those rubs. The Phantom didn't like sitting outside in the weather, and at first down there, before the rubs arrived, they literally were outside, and they had to be protected with sort of cockpit covers and the like to keep the water and what have you out of the cockpits. So the rubs were a huge advantage. Obviously, it was a hostile environment. You could get four seasons in a day, literally, at any time of the year. So the troops were working out in very difficult conditions. The aeroplanes were sitting out in those conditions as well. So quite hostile on the ground. You mentioned the diversions, and it was a real issue at Stanley. Stanley was right at the end of East Falklands. Each of the islands is roughly 60 miles across, I guess. So almost the first inkling of the weather was when it sort of encroached on West Falklands. There were no weather stations to the west, and certainly the ones that were, they weren't terribly keen about telling us what the weather was doing, because they were mostly in Argentina. So we didn't really have very good weather forecasting at all. So literally, the first you might know is when a nasty storm would roll across the airfield or whatever. And obviously, Stanley was it. That Mount Pleasant hadn't been built. There were no other diversions on the island. So literally, you were at the behest of a friendly nation on the South American coast, which I guess was probably Chile if it came to it. So you were almost paranoid about what type of weather you would get airborne in. But that said, we did have tankers. So if you did get airborne and you got caught out, then the tanker would launch and the tanker would have lots of fuel available.
And they were C-130s, weren't they?
They were at that time, yes. Yeah. The Victors were in and out, though, coming down from Ascension.
Right. Could they get into Stanley?
They didn't land at Stanley, but they used to come down into the airspace. But yes, the tankers down in the South Atlantic were C-130 tankers. I think we modified about half a dozen all in.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting reading about that. I didn't know that, actually.
The C-130 was a super tanker, actually. It was really good. And the crews were incredibly flexible. They would go anywhere at any height and basically come and help you out of a sticky corner.
Yeah.
So huge respect for the C-130 crews.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And Dave, in terms of the transit back up to the UK, what did you have to go through to prepare for that, and how long was it?
Well, it was quite an extensive planning exercise. Obviously, knowing your precise fuel figures and how much you had spare and what have you was important. So we planned it probably about a week in advance. And the original plan was Mount Pleasant had literally just opened up as a runway. And the idea was that the tankers, and they were going to be VC-10s for our first trip back, were going to land at Mount Pleasant and operate from there, and we were going to get airborne from Stanley because that's where the Phantoms were. So the plan was we had five tankers allocated. We would do what was called an RV echo, so we would get airborne at the same time, and then we would chase the tankers up the climb, join, and then they would take us all the way up to Ascension Island. Slowly, some tankers would peel back and land back at Mount Pleasant, and eventually two would go on and land at Ascension just behind us. That was the broad plan. Come the day, as always, no plan survives first contact with the enemy, and the enemy proved to be the headwinds. So when we looked at the winds on the day, we couldn't quite make it with the five tankers we had allocated. We ended up co-opting the C-130 from Stanley. Now, this made the plan so much more complicated, because what we had to do was get airborne, join the VC-10s initially. They were climbing up to their cruising height, which was about 20,000 feet, 25,000 feet. But then we had to descend down to 10,000 feet to meet the C-130 and get a top-off from the C-130. But then once we'd got that particular first bracket out of the way, then catch the VC-10s up. And as you can imagine, that was quite an exercise. And it exercised everything, including quite a bit of adrenaline, I think. But the plan worked. We took our fuel off the C-130 and then caught up the VC-10s literally just before the next tanker bracket, and and then we plugged in and it was go on from there.
And how long was that flight, Dave?
I think off the top of my head, the first one was about 8 hours long. Got airborne at late morning, and we landed in the dark at Ascension Island, which was quite exciting because it's quite a bumpy island. And then we had 24 hours off, and then we did another flight on from Ascension up to Coningsby, and that was 9 hours 30.
Wow.
So it was about 16 hours, the whole sortie.
Now, you had the pleasure of returning back down south, but in a different role and a different aircraft.
I did, yes. Some years later. In fact, funnily enough, looking in my logbook, it was October 1983. So it was 11 years almost to the month after the Phantoms had first landed at Stanley.
Yeah.
But by now, of course, Mount Pleasant had opened up fully. It was an active airbase, so I was actually stationed at Mount Pleasant Airfield as OC 1435 flight, so the little Tornado flight, which was four aeroplanes, around about five crews and 55 troops. So I had quite a little train set down there.
Yeah, you were the flight commander. How did you prepare for, I suppose, the defence of the Falklands as a flight commander? It was a different role for you from your first visit. How does one go about that?
Yeah, of course, flight commander, in the UK, you'd have a squadron commander controlling the squadron and then two flight commanders, you know, as subordinates. Of course, down there, OC Operations Wing, he was the airport manager. He owned the airfield and he owned all the squadrons. So the Sea Kings, the Chinooks, the C-130s and the Tornadoes. So he was effectively the boss of the airfield. But as flight commanders, we controlled our own little unit of aircraft. In terms of preparation, very little. I mean, I had just finished as the XO on the Tornado F3 operational conversion unit. So I'd spent 3 years training crews, you know, literally limited combat ready, not doing very much operational flying at all because of the training task. So I did have a short workup. My first pilot, and I had four pilots during my time down there who rotated through. My first pilot and I did about half a dozen sorties. We did some air combat against the Hawks, some air combat against the Hunters, which were representative of the type of threat we might feel we might meet down there, you know, the Argentinian type aeroplanes. And then literally launched down there, and within 2 days of arriving, I was sitting on QRA on Readiness 10. So... and I hadn't sat Q for about 8 years at that point, I think. So it was a bit of a baptism of fire.
A refreshing process. Tell us about the Tornado F3 and its capabilities in the role that it had to fulfil in the Falklands at that time.
Well, this of course, my time down there was sort of the mid-90s. So I got down there around about October of 93, and I was down there for 4 months. At that stage, the aeroplane, it wasn't the definitive standard of the Tornado. We had what was called a Stage 1 standard aeroplane. So it was the interim standard. It hadn't got the AMRAAM and ASRAAM. It hadn't got the latest radar or chaff and flares at that stage. So it was a bit of an interim standard. But that said, for the job it was doing, it was extremely capable because the Fox Hunter was working quite well by then. It was a fairly clear environment, you know, not lots of electronic noise or what have you. And we flew it clean wing, which gave us plenty of endurance for the sort of tasks we were doing. And in my time, we were carrying two Skyflash and four Sidewinders. So, you know, not quite a full weapon load and a full gun, of course. So we were able to operate typically an hour and a half, hour 45 sorties. Mostly overland. The airspace was wonderful. I mean, it was 250 feet to the moon, and you could do anything within that airspace that you wanted.
Yeah.
Noise complaints were non-existent because the islanders just loved us. We were their favourites. So we never had any problem like that. And in fact, the most complaints we got was when we didn't go out to the settlements to see them very often. So it was a fun environment.
Yeah. And Dave, the I know the F3 is a fighter variant, but were you ever expected to launch any offensive operations against mainland Argentina?
No, not at all. The role was purely defensive. Yeah. We were there to the four aeroplanes to stem any potential re-attack on the islands, and basically allow then the UK to reinforce. And there were fairly robust plans to be able to do that. We had no role at all in going outside the Falkland Islands protection zone. We did have a secondary strafe capability. We could use the gun air to ground. But that said, you know, that's not a very robust capability at all, really. Right. We were purely air to air.
And you talk in the book an awful lot about some of the exercises that you do. And as you mentioned a short while ago, exciting low level flying. But one of the things that I was intrigued about is how you worked with the other services. You mentioned the Army a little earlier. The thing that really comes across, given all the rather negative comments about inter-service challenges, is how well you worked with the Navy and the Army. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think it helped being on the same station. Obviously, the Army lived at Mount Pleasant as well. The Navy, when they were in port, it was Mere Harbour, which was literally just sort of 5 minutes down the road from Mount Pleasant as well. Very, very close liaison and relationships with both of the services. Both of them exercised quite heavily, and we would support them where we could. There were two particular exercises that come to mind. The Army disappeared off into the field, and it was a resident infantry company that was down there at the time. And they would go, you know, sort of do their exercises out in the in over East Falkland. And so we would provide pseudo hostile aeroplanes, so, you know, air attacks to allow them to exercise their drills, and particularly their air defense drills, because they carried embedded ground-to-air weapons. So we would act as the bad guys and let them exercise against us. Equally with the Navy, obviously the Navy were, after the Falklands War, were paranoid about the Exocet threat. We essentially had a system where the Hercules would act as an étendard, and we would act as two Exocet missiles, as the Tornadoes. So we would accelerate away from the Hercules, simulate as much as we could the profile that an Exocet would fly, and then allow the Navy to go through their engagement drills in order to be able to prevent being attacked by an Exocet. Yeah. So it was that kind of inter-service sort of support and support.
And
very, very close.
You talk in the book about going into air traffic control and even having the opportunity to visit, I think it was HMS Newcastle, you talk about in the book, to see it from the other side. Is that a view you don't often get in flying fast jets?
Yeah, it is. It was very difficult in UK to get onto a boat and go, you know, see how the Navy operated. Generally, maritime exercises, they were well away from the UK coastline, so it was a very difficult opportunity to have. Whereas if Newcastle pulled into Mare Harbour, then we could literally we went aboard, we could see the we could see their weapon systems, we could see how they operated and what have you. But they were very keen to have what they called a sea day. So they would take a number of RAF people out on the ship and we'd disappear out into the waters, the coastal waters. And then they would go through all their weapons drills. They would show us how the Sea Dart would pop up, and they showed us how it was loaded and what have you. Didn't fire one of those. But what they did do was they fired the GPMGs that they had around the ship. They fired the close-in weapon system, the Phalanx, and various other bits and pieces that they had on board, including the 4.5-inch gun, which was hugely impressive. But, they were very proud of their capabilities. And we also, of course, then got the opportunity to watch a couple of Tornadoes doing a ship attack watch the, you know, from the ops room how they handled it all the drills and got to see the kit in action. So, yeah, very, very interesting for an aviator.
And as your role as flight commander, how much flying did you get to do? Were you part of the active QRA teams?
Yes, I was one of the five crews. So as I say, we cycled the other crews through every 4 to 5 weeks, so because they had to go back to the UK and do simulators, so they had to be down there just for a short time. But I was there for 4 months as the boss. So my pilots kept rotating every few weeks. I was a full and active member of the team, and we were all on a 10-day cycle. So we generally, out of that 10 days, we would probably fly 2 or 3 days. I was getting sort of 15, 20 hours a month. So it was probably a lot more than I was getting back in UK as an instructor.
And what were the conditions like second time around? I know first time you were down there, there was living out of huts and things. What were the conditions like second time around?
Yeah, the first time down in Stanley, I was lucky. I mean, by the time I arrived, the Coastels were in place, which were the... they were sort of oil rig accommodation vessels, I think they were. So fairly austere conditions, but much better than the tents and what have you that people had been living in up to that point. But Mount Pleasant was palatial in comparison. You know, the conditions were very good. It had been designed to take the number of people that were there. And, you know, the rooms were, well, they were small, but very, very comfortable. And, generally speaking, we were very well placed.
And Dave, you are very active. We've spoken to you a few times. Have you been back to the Falklands since?
No, I haven't, sadly. It's an awful long way.
Yeah.
It would be nice to go back, but the thought of that time on an aeroplane, you know, it's more fun than I can handle, probably.
So just to wrap up then, what's your lasting memories of the two postings, and what sort of experience do you think it brought to you?
I think the thing that I will never forget are the people. The Falkland Islands are hugely impressive. Lovely people, very patriotic, more British than we are. And they enjoy their lifestyle. They want to be a British dependency. They say it every day of the week. So lovely people. The wildlife, it's one of the most unique places in the world, I think, that... you know, the penguins, the seals, the sea lions, you know, you name it. There's all sorts of wildlife down there. And it's the sort of thing that you can't wander around the UK and see. So lasting memory there. But I think having your own little train set, being that far from home, the powers that be were not terribly interested, providing you did the job that you were supposed to do. In other words, defend the airfield.
Yeah.
And the islands, of course. So having that autonomy, it was probably something I didn't have again. My span of control was much smaller. You know, the outfit was tiny.
Yeah.
And I just left after being the deputy of the conversion unit, which was 20-odd aeroplanes and 150 troops and 50 instructors and anything up to 50 students. Massive organization. But just having that nice little tight unit down there was quite a thrill. And I think probably the lasting memory would be utter exhaustion. That by the end of 4 months, working essentially every day with no time off and very little beer involved, I think I slept for a week when I climbed off the aeroplane at this end.
And the book Fighters Over the Falklands, of course, is subtitled Defending the Islanders' Way of Life. So I think that's your little credit back to that statement you made earlier. Dave, thank you very much for joining us. But just before we go, where can we find out a little bit more about you, your books, and some of the other things you're involved in?
Well, my website's out there. It's on Webnode, and it's called DG Media is my the title. So you can find the information on all the books on the webpage. Each of the books, and I've written 12 now, 6 factual, 6 fiction. They all have their own little Facebook page, so if anybody's interested, then check that out. But if you Google David Gledhill author, then I'll pop up regularly and lots of interviews, lots of book reviews and the like. So I'm easy to find.
Thanks very much, Dave. Well, The Fighters Over the Falklands, the book, is well worth a read. Really, really enjoyed it. There's some fascinating stories and a real great insight, like a lot of your other factual books, into real operational detail. So really enjoyed it, and a fascinating look at what happened after events had come to a close in the Falklands War. So, Dave, thank you very much again for your time.
My pleasure as always, Peter. Good to speak to you.
Well, Dave's almost as regular a guest as you, Matt, on the on the show. I think he's fighting for the accolade of most appearances. But interesting stuff from Dave Gledhill, as always. Again, the conditions came up of how challenging it was down there, particularly like the story of the using the Hercules to shudder the runway up and down, and the fact that they'd used the C-130s for refueling. I wasn't aware of that post the conflict.
No, I think it's, it was obviously a very useful aircraft to have, the fact that it just had that much more flexibility than the jet tankers, and obviously it could operate from Stanley, it gave them that extra options that they needed to operate. And it does sound, I don't know that much about the use of the Hercules as a tanker, but it sounds like it was an extremely capable aircraft, and Dave was obviously very complimentary about it and the use of it there.
Keen to see them when they were starting to get a bit empty, the old F3 particular, a bit of a thirsty monster. So they got them out of a few holes. And conditions again played a part in how tricky it is to operate in that part of the world, Tim. Dave also talks about his first tour of duty and the use of Victor's, I think, 5 or 6 VC-10s to get those 2 airframes back.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is it's important because a lot of the time people, and particularly, public politicians don't realize the logistics of kind of air power or everyone's kind of familiar, I suppose, with the black book mission, but they just don't realize that if you want to go long haul with a fighter jet, you need tankers to support it. It needs to be tanker trail. You need a whole load of crews, whole load of aircraft. It's all going to be, planned out and to get just 2 assets from the South Atlantic back. So, yeah, awful lot of work.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, it's difficult to underestimate the sheer distance that the Falklands are away, and it's easy to kind of forget that. But, you think once the task force has gone down there, but just that sort of air bridge of keeping those the islands supplied over with sort of 8-9 hour flights stages of 8-9 hours is astonishing, really.
Yeah,
and I think also that again comes back to my earlier point on sort of serious air forces, on serious war fighting air forces, expeditionary capability. People obviously worried about the rise of Russian air power. They've got a lot of kit, been using it recently, and then you look how many tankers they've got compared to the US Air Force, and you just think, not many, 19. I think 19 aerial refuelers. So
doesn't get you far these days, does it?
Well, it's a difference. It's a difference between that kind of air power to send air power long place, far away.
And great stories as well from Dave. When we talked about complaints about the noise, there were no complaints about the noise.
Yeah, no complaints about the noise. The reverse, apparently, if you're in the Falklands, you got complaints when they didn't fly low and kind of scream over your cottage. Obviously, they were forces in the immediate aftermath of the Falklands were the heroes. Islanders were pleased to pleased to see them, grateful, and also as I suppose there's the economic impact that we don't really sort of think about of the Stanley base being built up, as it were, of people coming in and sort of putting money into the economy there post-war, suddenly turning this into sort of the UK's one of the UK's best defended outposts in the aftermath.
Tim, what's the current state of play down there? Is it typhoons? How many typhoons have we got down there?
I believe there's 4 typhoons. There is, I'd like to say, Chinook.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say also maybe still be a C-130 down there, sort of dual-roled as long-range SAR, stroke air-to-air refueling.
Right, okay.
I'm not sure whether a Voyager is down there all the time or whether it just kind of
takes passengers.
The search and rescue, the sort of Sea Kings that used to do search and rescue is now performed by a civil company on a contract.
And also interesting that given the feedback we had in the first two episodes about in-service rivalry, how complimentary Dave was about the RAF, the Army and the Navy working together, and it just proves when left alone to do the right thing happens. And, you know, talking about going onto the ship and watching the tornadoes come in and do dummy attacks, he could see it from the opposite perspective, which I thought was really interesting. And I'm sure as a flight commander, seeing that from that perspective must have been very useful for him in terms of tactics and other things. But really nice to hear some positive inter-service cooperation.
Definitely. And I think it's that was very refreshing, actually. And I think it makes it clear that when the services understand each other, particularly on an operational level, then they can work well together and kind of appreciate each other's problems and so on. It was interesting that it was more at the sort of command level where Dave felt that they weren't really communicating. And also from the previous interview as well, there was that sort of slight disconnect the higher you went. But there's no good reason why the services can't work well together once they sort of put these sort of political differences aside. But I suppose it's only natural that each service, they're fiercely loyal to the service that they're that they're serving, and they want the best for that service. People like Sharky Ward are fighting for the best kit. They see other services getting what they perceive to be the lion's share of the resources and so on. They'll naturally fight against that. So it's a natural thing, but it's only sort of looking from outside it can appear that it sometimes may be a bit destructive and things turn from, there's a sort of fine line between competitive and rivals. But it was actually quite refreshing to hear, I think, in both interviews that it can work well when the conditions are there, and particularly when they're actually working together. It's when they're separated that maybe there is that lack of understanding, and you start to get the rumours about the RAF moving Australia 500 miles to prove that they can cover the globe with land-based aircraft and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I think there was it obviously benefits down there in that it's a small force that's down there. Everybody knows everybody else. And maybe you could also add into that I wouldn't actually sort of say boredom, but things to do to occupy, you can't kind of nip into London or nip into kind of people sort of disappear over the weekend, so that it's kind of occupied. What are you going to do, how are you going to kind of fill the schedule, what training do you need to do? And lo and behold, you've got the Navy there, them all, and they've got a destroyer nearby, and it's fairly easy to work it that way. Whereas he did sort of say in back in the UK it was a lot more sort of difficult to organise that sort of experience.
This is true. And also I think once the feeling you get that they're so far away from London that things are a little bit more flexible, you don't have millions of forms to fill out necessarily to make it happen. Yeah. But this is actually something, it was interesting to me because it's something that they used to do and I think they probably still do to an extent in the Fleet Air Arm, in the anti-submarine force in particular, is that the air crews would go out on frigates and to do the anti-submarine work from a ship, and then they would spend some time on a submarine to get the impression of what it was like from that side and get a feel for the tactics that were used and just really get inside the head of the people that you're working with on the one hand and also will be working against. So it makes a lot of sense, and it's to be able to do that across services as well, I think is probably very healthy.
Well, big thank you to Dave Gledhill again for spending that time with us. Okay, quick break and we'll come back with some feedback on part one and part two of this series.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, let's get some feedback on the first two parts of this series. And we would like to just thank everybody so far who has downloaded the show, listened to the show, and given us feedback. Certainly part two was by far our most popular episode ever. And when we released the episode and it got onto the social media feeds, I think at one moment we were getting a copy downloaded every 20 seconds for a good few hours. So the good old servers at Global Aviation Resource, which is where we host the show, were under a lot of pressure. I think we ended up in the first couple of weeks at about 30,000 downloads for part two, which of course was the part with Commander Sharky Ward. So let's get some feedback. Not all of it. We literally had hundreds and hundreds of comments and pieces of information, so we picked a few out. Ewan Leach gave us a pat on the back, very, very grateful for that, Ewan, but he felt that Sharky Ward's interview was brilliantly honest, which I think was one of the more polite ways of putting it. If let's go on and cut to the chase. The feedback really got interesting. Navy Lookout, who of course great supporters of the show, wrote, "Some of his claims are nuts, particularly carriers' top weight issues, and he was wrong to claim that F-35 pilots are being forced to lie about how good it is." Matt, let me come to you then as our naval hair historian.
Thanks.
And and Mr. Ward's comments, we did know that this would ruffle some feathers. I think he was quite honest and quite direct in what he believed, but there was quite a lot of debate on social media about this, particularly about this issue of top weight and the capability of the F-35. Where do you stand on it all?
Well, I'm remaining very much neutral, I think, on the on these issues. I haven't seen or heard enough authoritatively to make a decision. I think I'm erring on the side that the F-35 will be very capable. As for the top weight problem, I couldn't possibly comment. I mean, I admit to an intake of breath when I heard Sharky Ward suggesting that they should just scrap the Queen Elizabeth class and start afresh, because I think if they lose those carriers, I don't think there's any chance they're going to get new ones, maybe ever, certainly for a very long time. But so I was a little astonished at that claim, I will be honest. But again, I think probably my sense of it is that will it be perfect? Probably not. Will the fleet air arm be able to get the absolute maximum from it, and probably more than expected? History suggests yes, they will. They do have an awful lot more going for them than the Invincible class in many ways, just in terms of sheer size and you know, flexibility and so on and so forth. And the fact that they will operate one as a helicopter carrier and one as the fast jet carrier, but just having two gives them the flexibility to swap over, and you know, when the time comes, be able to operate both as aircraft carriers if they need to, and so on and so forth. So I think, it's still unproven yet. It's very early days, but, time will tell.
And Tim, you had the pleasure of interviewing Commander Ward. You saw the feedback. How do you feel about some of the feedback? I mean, Glenn Towler goes on to say Sharky Ward made lots of good points about how the F-35 is not very good as a carrier aircraft. Everyone waded in on that, but I don't think Commander Ward was being negative or being particularly abrasive just for the sake of it. He genuinely believes the process that got us to the point of the F-35 was broken.
Well, I mean, he's when you have the top scoring Sea Harrier pilot from the Falklands War who went down there, stared the elephant in the eye, came back, and one of the top fighter pilots of his age, you have to take his claim seriously. This is someone with real operational experience. This is someone who is combat hardened. This is someone who knows what he's talking about. So I think you have to give it you have to look at his claims. But at the same time, some of the stuff that he mentions in his own book is that within the Sea Harrier community, and particularly within his squadron, they were utterly confident about what this aircraft would do. They'd flown rings around aggressors. They'd taken on F-15s. They were the mutt's nuts. Yeah, people outside looked at it and looked on paper, went, this is subsonic. Oh, we're hearing reports about the radar not being very good. It's a new aircraft. There's only eight of them, and there's only a very small force. It's not as good as a Phantom. We heard in the previous episodes about somebody coming down from the MOD, an analyst probably from DERA, and giving a sober briefing about you're going to die down there, and having to be quietly escorted from the room because the pilots were his views was let me at them. Yeah. This is the stuff you hear back from the F-35 community as well. It's, these guys are raring to go. They would love somebody to be stupid enough to come on and try and find out how good the F-35 is. So you wonder whether it's technology has moved on in some ways, like. In his day, the radar was good enough. The aircraft navigation and avionics were good enough to do sort of this sort of single pilot operations. You wonder whether there's a future Sharky Ward at the moment, kind of going, we know for certain there is. They're coming. I can't believe all this stuff about the bad publicity about the F-35. I love it. It's amazing. Where is all this bad press coming from?
I think we've got enough outspoken leaders, particularly in the Fleet Air Arm, but I'm sure in the RAF as well, that if what they were seeing on the F-35 was as bad as some make out, that we would have heard about it by now. I haven't heard a bad report from a pilot.
Obviously pilots want to fly aircraft. The F-35 is the newest aircraft on the block. So if you are just about to sort of finish pilot selection, probably don't want to be bad mouthing it there. we've heard this stuff from kind of exercises now that's kind of leaking out, and every pilot said, this is amazing, this is sort of transformative, jury is still out until it's actually being blooded in combat, but there you go. But Sharky Ward,
he's done it.
I think you have to take him seriously. And it's interesting stuff about we were talking of him. I think about UAVs and air combat. And it's interesting in the last couple of months, we had a US Navy fighter shot down a Syrian Su-22 over Syria. First US sort of manned fighter kill in about 20 years. And it's a carrier fighter, So the idea that maybe dogfights have gone away, Yeah, perhaps not.
Well, let's pick up a few other bits of feedback before we close things up.
I just want to say that I don't mean to suggest that that Sharky Ward, I think he wouldn't say these things if he didn't absolutely believe them, because the one thing we do know about him is that he is absolutely brutally honest in all situations and wouldn't, you know, say things if he didn't have good reasons to. So, you know, we will have to see what time tells, really. But I think the view that I had from Navy sources back in 2012, when the switch was made back to, you know, back to the F-35B, was that kind of, did we want cats and traps? We would have preferred them. However, now we really want to get behind what we've got, and the choice has been made, and we want to make the best of it, which I think the Fleet RM always does. So, you know, we will see.
Good friend from Down Under, Grant, sent us a lot of very positive feedback. Thanks for that, Grant. But we also unleashed the "you've got to go out and buy all the books now," so we took a bit of stick for that. But he did make the point that if Galtieri had waited 3 months to invade, the UK carriers would have been scrapped due to Whitehall's stupidity. And as per Sandy's book, Whitehall thought the Fleet Air Arm was obsolete and anti-aircraft missiles were the way to go. So it's interesting. It's great, you know, Monday morning quarterback, as they say. We can all look back and look at those issues. But it was dealt with the equipment that was available at the time. So I think, yes, he could have delayed it, but hey-ho, that's the way it goes, as they say. Grant also said he lived in Argentina, which I was aware of for a couple of years, and he does say that some still say Las Malvinas son nuestros, I think that is. So I'm sure I haven't pronounced that right, Grant, and I'm sure you'll correct us on that. But he does say there's views from every perspective about the war, and we do hope that the final part of this feature on the air war will be the Argentine angle. So our pre-Christmas episode, we hope to be part four of the air war for the Falklands, and will be the Argentine angle on that. So there we go. Anything else on the feedback before we wrap up, chaps?
Obviously the issue of timing is an interesting one, and the fact that Invincible was going to be sold to Australia. Obviously Illustrious was still on its way, and I don't think there was any plans to lose Illustrious. Correct me if I'm wrong, but so, you know, it may have been that at whatever time the invasion took place, we would have had at least one carrier and probably two still available. So I don't know about that, but it's you know, there might have been a window, you know, who knows. I mean, Hermes was not going to be around forever, you know, so there may have been a window, and it is it's an interesting one to interesting what if to ponder. But yeah, I think it's unquestionable that there probably was the view that that missiles were the way forward, and you know, fighter air defense was maybe not as important as it would have been, but the Falklands really did change that. And as Tim pointed out, dogfights are still with us, and it's still Navy aircraft doing the shoot downs.
I mean, one thing that we did come up in the previous couple of episodes was a question on Nimrod's from kind of on intelligence missions. I think we discussed that about. Yeah. That was pretty kind of a grey area, sort of sneaky peeky stuff. How exactly were Chile helping? And one book I read recently, recommended is "Kisses from Nimbus," from SAS to MI6 by PJ Red Riley. Very, very interesting book. A chap who started off as an Army Air Corps pilot, went to support the Special Air Service at Hereford, ended up as sort of like a special intelligence wing for MI6, doing all kinds of interesting stuff. But when he was in 1982, he was sent on a mission to go and reconnaissance the Argentine air bases from Chile as an SAS a trooper stroke pilot, and ended up borrowing, with full knowledge apparently, a Huey, and had a observer there taking close enough to take pictures of the airbase.
Wow.
The Southern Air Force. Now, what would that be? That'd be, what's the name, it escapes me at the moment. So anyway, very, very interesting story. Flew low over the, low over the border, got these pictures, unmasked over a hill, just quick enough to grab a few pictures off. They must have been very, very close indeed if you are taking pictures in a UH-1, and scootled back to base. So that is an interesting story that I've never heard before. That we've heard stuff about the helicopter that crash landed in Chile. He was involved in that, in getting some of the the weapons back to the UK and equipment back to there in the diplomatic bag. So yeah, really, really interesting stuff. If you want to have sort of an insight into some of the sort of intelligence stuff in the Falklands War, kisses from Nimbus.
Okay, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to say a very special thank you to Philip Crabtree and Dave Gledhill, and of course Matt, for your time in supporting and producing both this episode and the previous episodes. Thanks very much, Matt.
You're very welcome.
Now, you can find Extended on all the popular podcast players, and of course it is on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at RES Tim R, and the Royal Aeronautical Society is online at www.aerosociety.com.
And Matt, how about you? Can you remind us where we can look you up online?
My website is navalairhistory.com. I'm on Twitter at navalairhistory.
And you can find Gareth Stringer at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there will be a final part to this series of features on the air war, and that will be the Argentine angle. So looking very much forward to hearing that episode. So, with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Matt Willis.
Good night.
It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
But Baco foil in the F-35 repair kit. Yeah, probably not. they were the Mutz Nuts.
This is XTP Media.